Future Proof. Proudly supported by Science Foundation Ireland.
Hashtag believe in science.
Hello and welcome to the Future Proof podcast. This is the show where we take a closer look at the world around us. My name is Jonathan McRae. As always, if you'd like to contact us, you can email us, science@newstalk.com, or you can follow us 24/7 on the Twitter machine at @NewstalkScience. This week, we're going to be talking about lots of different things. The science marches on. We're also going to be talking about how lions choose what to eat, which is a really interesting story. And we'll be speaking to a really interesting guest, Jacques Cousteau's granddaughter. You might be aware of Jacques Cousteau's work as a conservationist filmmaker and pretty prolific environmentalist. His granddaughter is now continuing the family tradition and making environmental films for National Geographic. She'll be talking about her life and the legacy of her grandfather and father. But first, before we get into the week's science news, we're joined in studio by Dr. Jessamine Fairfield from NUI Galway to talk about the March for Science, which is happening today at 2 p.m. in the Grand Canal Square. Jessamine, you're very welcome. How are you?
I'm great, Jonathan. Thanks for having me on.
So I have to say, I was rung by Sean O'Boyle, who's one of the organisers of the march, a while back, and he said, you know, are you going to march for science? And I was like, well, it sort of seems like marching for an idea as opposed to an action. And I wasn't sold. And now I am very sold. Why should people march for science?
Well, science is something that matters to all of us, that has a huge impact on our day-to-day lives, whether we're scientists or not. You know, the innovations that we rely on, the things around us, and just the research that kind of keeps us healthy and well and interacting with each other. And I think most people would know this, but, you know, especially in sort of recent years, in the political climate in a lot of countries has started to turn against sort of basic research and the sort of research that does help people. And especially, I think, with Trump, you know, in America. And so the March for Science was kind of born out of that just after Trump's inauguration. Some people started to have an idea of, you know, why don't we organize a March for Science to show that we need evidence-based policy, you know, we need to keep international mobility for researchers, which is so important, and we need to show that science is a part of culture and not a thing that's separate from it. And so the March for Science in Ireland is actually part of a global movement of, I think at this point, more than 600 marches in different cities around the world, some of which have already happened. You know, the ones in Australia and Asia have been going on, tens of thousands of people turning out to support science. And the Irish one is this afternoon, which is really exciting.
So one of the things that I think probably people don't realize is that you don't get to have a society where a lot of people don't trust scientists overnight. And that's why I think the March for Science, why I came around to the idea that it's really important to march for the idea of science, rational thinking and skepticism, because I'm surrounded by people who are tweeting me saying, you know, that there's chemical trails in the air because of airplanes, that vaccines cause autism, that faith healing may save your child from cancer. I see these stories all the time. There are people out there who are getting much better at communicating anti-science, and they're getting an audience in this country. And I think,
yeah,
the point for me to march is drawing along this line in the sand and saying, if you're going to make an extraordinary claim, you need extraordinary evidence.
Yeah.
Science is our way of estimating what is true and what is not.
Absolutely. And I think especially in terms of, you know, the politicians that we have, you know, not just in other countries, but even here, you know, the fact that you can even have a politician who can say, oh, well, we can't do anything about the weather, like that's God's business. Like, people should not be voting for a politician who would be willing to say that. Like, you need to value evidence. And, you know, science isn't just a body of facts. It's a process for how we determine what is true and isn't. And it's the best one that we have. So we need to value that and to understand that it feeds into policy, it feeds into our day-to-day lives. You know, it's making things better for us, and not just for scientists, but for everybody.
Yeah, and I think someone described science as the process of getting things less wrong over time. And I think that's a brilliant illustration of the fact that science is not a perfect system. It doesn't get everything right. There are mistakes, there are revisions, but that is how we get to being more familiar with how things work in the world. And I think that's why people should march. If you would like to go, depending on where you are, you still have time to grab some food and join us in the Grand Canal Square at 2 p.m. to march to government buildings. Dr. Jessamine Fairfield, thanks very much. All right, it's time to have a look back at the week's news. And joining us in the studio are Dr. Fergus McAuliffe from ICRAG and Dr. Laura Dungan. You're both very welcome.
Thank you, Jonathan.
Thank you.
How are you?
To maintain various levels of silence through that, I do appreciate it.
I'm just still giggling at your absolute coffee high from this morning.
I know, it's just one of those days. Okay, our first story.
This is life's ultimate cruelty. It offers us the taste of youth and vitality, and then makes us witness our own decay.
That was from Death Becomes Her, in case you were wondering, because Fergus looks very confused. This is kind of a bizarre movie.
Oh, it stayed with me for a really long time.
Did it?
Really, really freaked me out when I saw it as a kid. When she gets a whole shotgun blast through her stomach and she survives and she kind of has to just fill it in with polyfill.
It's about the search for eternal youth. There's some weird scenes. There's a bizarre sort of jewel tiara boob thing.
Yeah, when the boobs come back up. Yeah, great movie.
But moving on. This is about research that sort of builds on some of the things that we've been talking about. The first story that really amazed people a long time ago was the idea that old mice given young blood from young mice became in some ways young again.
Yeah, this actually started back in the 1950s, where a very revolutionary or terrifying Frankenstein-like scientist attached the blood supplies of old and young mice that were alive together, and he found that the tendons and the muscles of the old mice became younger. And this new research, which is published in Nature just this week, is, if you're a science nerd, you're just going to love it. Like, the process is so beautiful. They do science so, so well. And this is from Joseph Castellano from Stanford University. And what they did was they took blood from people in their 60s to 80s, people in their early 20s, and from the umbilical cords of freshly or newly born babies. So three very different stages of life. And they compared the bloods. And what they found, first of all, is that there were big differences. So then they took mice, old mice, and they injected the three different types of blood. So baby blood. And before people start getting really freaked out, this is from the umbilical cords, which does not have sensation, so the babies cannot feel this. And they injected the different types of blood in. And what they found was, when they put these old mice into a maze test, which is a very standard test of memory and learning, that they escaped the maze far faster if they had got the baby blood.
And this is human babies.
This is human baby blood. And they didn't stop there. This is so beautiful. Like, they first of all checked the brains themselves. They looked to see if there was any differences. There were differences in the hippocampus, which is the center of learning and memory. They then they'd already put the baby blood in. Then they tested the different proteins in this blood to see what was there in the baby blood and not in the old blood. They found a protein, which I love, because people love publishing things that just don't have any answer. This has a protein. It's called TIMP2, and it stops a type of chemical called matrix metalloproteinases. Anyway, it's very detailed, but it's very interesting. Then they took that out of the baby blood and they injected it into the mice again, and they found the mice weren't good. They were still old mice that could not get through a maze. So they had the baby blood with the protein, baby blood without the protein, and it was only this particular protein that worked. And they injected the protein in and they found that it really changed the mice. Massive learning and memory improvements. So it's really exciting. I mean, this isn't just basic research. They've found the protein here. Now, it is very basic. I'm not talking about like vampire baby attacks around Ireland. This isn't going to help. It's not going to cure Alzheimer's. But it's really exciting to have a protein that can be synthesized in a lab. So you don't have to have this from baby blood donations. This can be synthesized in a lab completely separate from any human blood donations. It's just really, exciting.
The thing that blew my mind is that we're talking about human blood in mice.
So they had to use a special type of mouse that is called a skid mouse, so it doesn't react to the blood as if, because it would react. This is like a graft host sort of defense thing. It would have an immunological response and it would probably kill the mouse. So they had to use special mice that didn't have an immune response. But then when they purified out just the protein, they were able to put that into regular mice and it still worked. So it's so exquisite. I love the science here. I'm such a geek.
The potential for a protein that could be used as a therapy to restore youth is pretty
brain youth. Yeah, they're talking about the hippocampus.
I suppose, you know.
Well, I mean, Jesus.
No, for sure. Yeah. But like, it's the most important.
Yeah, for you and I and regular people, yes, it is.
I have so many things I'm thinking in my head. Fergus, a second story has to do with a worm.
Yes, it does. And it turns out that the worm actually isn't a worm. Oh. That's what I learned. One of the cool things, it's actually a clam. So you have these things called shipworms, and they are a type of clam that eat the wood of rotting ships.
What?
Yes.
Okay.
Yeah. So they go in and they kind of burrow in and they're basically able to digest the wood. Okay. Now we have this thing called the giant shipworm, and this is kind of a mysterious creature because all we've ever seen of it up until now has been kind of fossil relics of it. So it's got a hard kind of outer shell, and that's all we've managed to see until this week, when, inspired by YouTube and seeing a video on it, a group of scientists from Northeastern University traveled all the way up to the Philippines to Mindanao Bay, and they sent down a team of divers, basically to about 10 foot of depth, and at that depth they saw these giant shipworms sticking up out of the mud. So what did they look like? So they're about the same size and shape and width as a baseball bat. Okay, so if you imagine a baseball bat, right, and you're going to turn it upside down, so the handle now is at the top and the part that you hit the ball is at the bottom. You're going to stick that down into the mud, okay? So most of the giant shipworms actually in the mud, and all that's sticking up is the kind of handle.
Okay.
At the end of that handle, it's got two little siphons, right, that kind of wiggle around, and those siphons are really, really important. So what the scientists said is they actually took out some of the shipworms in their cases, okay, this hard case, and they knocked off the top of the case and out spilled this long, really, really muscular worm. And it's important that it's muscular as well, okay? Usually shipworms, they have a really extensive digestive system because they need to eat wood, okay? So a lot of their body volume is given over to the digestive system. Not the case here. Here it's mostly muscle. So the scientists were like, what's going on here? Why is it so muscular? Why doesn't it have this big digestive system to digest the wood? What's actually happening is that in through one of those siphons at the top is coming seawater, okay? And that seawater is rich in hydrogen sulfide because it's a really low oxygen area. Hydrogen sulfide is like the smell of rotting eggs, the smell of kind of mud flats. And this seawater passes in through the siphon and passes over the gills of the shipworm. On the gills are a special bacteria that reduce that hydrogen sulfide to sulfate. That releases energy. The shipworm is then able to use that energy to convert carbon dioxide in the water into organic compounds, the exact same way as what happens in almost photosynthesis. So this is chemosynthesis. So that's why the digestive system is so small, because it's able to get all of its energy actually from the seawater.
Mate, and on top of that, it's a pretty, cool/gross looking thing. It's like, about 3 feet long, and basically looks like a large pitch black wet worm with sort of tentacles. Properly gross.
It's absolutely gross. But however, if you spend most of your life upside down in with like 3/4 of your body stuck in the mud, I don't think aesthetics are going to be of any concern to you, really.
True. Third story has to do with this, possibly the most controversial fossil in history, the Homo floresiensis, the hobbit fossil.
I'm glad you said it first, because I actually find I struggle to say it. In 2003, a skeleton was found on this small island of Flores in Indonesia, and it was only about 3.5 feet tall. And there has been debate left, right and centre over this ever since it was found. People are saying that it was Homo erectus, left Africa, arrived to this small island. Then there was very few resources and nutrients, so they shrunk and shrunk and shrunk until they got to about 3.5 feet tall, and then they died. Other people say that it was a normal Homo sapien who had microcephaly or Down syndrome. So it seems now new research from the Australian National University is actually poo-pooing all of this. And this is really exciting, because it's saying that there was a common ancestor that we don't know. And from that, Homo habilis, which we do know existed in Africa, came. But they're also saying this other descendant, this hobbit, this floresiensis, came out from this unknown ancestor. And they say about 2 million years ago, before Homo erectus ever left Africa, that these guys actually left. And about 700,000 years ago, they made it to this little island. And they managed to survive, even though Homo erectus wiped out all their brethren. But Homo erectus seemed to have never made it to this tiny island. So they survived. They were tiny little guys who kept on going until we came along. So 60,000 years ago, Homo sapiens came along and killed them all. But it seems like really interesting research, because they compared the skull, jaw, teeth, arms, legs and shoulder fossils from these 9 partial skeletons. And they say that they have far more similarity to Homo habilis, which is this potentially further back common ancestor, than erectus or sapiens. So it does seem like really good research, which just further kind of deepens the mystery around this tiny, adorable little hobbit from 60,000 years ago.
Yeah, so there was a bit of controversy about this. We did a really good piece on this a few years back, when this supposed extremely important fossil of a type of Homo that was found in this unusual place in Indonesia. And we got this scientist on, who was published in a very well-known journal called the National Proceedings of the Academy of Sciences. And in this journal, he basically said, it's not a fossil. It's just a human with Down syndrome.
Yeah.
And we couldn't believe that this was the published version of what had happened, because we've been told this was a really important
fact. And it was in PNAS as well. Yeah, it was in a good journal.
And so we had the original paleontologist on after that. And we said, wait, hang on a second, what is this? And they basically, this enormous spat happened between the two scientists, and the scientist who we interviewed said, please remove my interview. I don't want to give you that interview anymore. And I said, and we said at the time, we went, no.
The podcast, yeah, they wanted it down.
We'd pre-recorded this interview and they said they wanted to retract the interview. And the problem is they'd already publicly said this is what they thought, that this particular...
And published it.
And published it. And I think the debate and the pressure politically and academically seems to have increased. But it was an amazing story, and it just goes to show that paleontologists really don't always agree.
No, a lot of drama.
Yeah, it's a really, really interesting story. But so the current thinking is that this is one of an early versions of Homo that actually made it out of Africa.
Long before Homo erectus. It's really exciting.
And we came from Homo erectus.
I think so, yeah, didn't we? Yes, we did. Yeah, absolutely.
I got a text from Uganda. Looking forward to my weekly science fix. As ever, greetings from Lion Country. Looking forward to hearing your response to that, Jerry. Thanks very much for your tweet. We don't get too many response from Uganda. Fergus, our final story has to do with possibly a silver bullet to flu.
Yes, so I'm always a big fan of a good frog, and in particular of this one called Hydrophylax bahuvistara, only discovered in 2015 in the forests of India. So it looks like that some of its frog slime could be a remedy for flu. So scientists from Vanderbilt University, they went over into these forests in India and they captured some of the frogs. They're really distinctive. They've got a really nice kind of orange, like a paint almost, or stripe down the back. And they took them into the lab and gave them just a friendly little mild electric shock that caused them to secrete some some frog slime.
Wait, okay? What?
Just a little one. You know, just kind of, what? How you doing, little one.
Why would you do that?
Just to get them to secrete the slime as a protective response to the electric shock.
Okay.
Okay, so now, so that means we have the slime. So then they took the slime and they isolated that down into basically a number of different peptides. These are just short chain molecules. They took those then and they vaccinated some mice with these peptides, and then they gave the mice some swine flu to see if the vaccine would work. Now,
how do they know? Were they just throwing everything at it, or why do they think swine flu might be?
Because it's kind of to do with this, movement out there to try and get like a universal flu vaccine.
Okay.
So they were trying a lot of different things, and what they found was that often these antiviral peptides will actually destroy human red blood cells as well. But there was one particular one in this frog slime that didn't. And what it did is it attached to a surface protein on the virus, on the flu virus, called hemagglutinin, and basically destabilized that, so rendering the virus now ineffective. It's really important that if you ever find yourself with the flu out in India, that you don't go around the place licking all these frogs, because three out of the four peptides on this frog will actually kill your red blood cells. It's just this one, and they named it Uramin, after an Indian sword called a Urumi with a flexible blade that acts like a whip and is used in martial arts.
This show, I thought last show was random. This is a pretty random show. Very interesting stuff. Fergus McAuliffe and Dr. Lauren Duggan, thank you very much for joining us.
Future Proof, proudly supported by Science Foundation Ireland.
# believe in science.
When you think about it, human beings should be a pretty good source of nutrition for an animal like a big cat. But actually, lions and tigers rarely eat us. Why is that? And what has to happen before one of these animals turns into a man-eater? Joining us now to tell us is Larissa DeSantis. She's a paleontologist and assistant professor at Vanderbilt University. You're very welcome to the program, Larissa. How are you?
Great. Thanks so much for having me.
So am I right in saying that if lions had a lineup of all the mammals in the world, human beings would not rate very highly in the deliciousness scale?
Well, it's hard to know how sort of yummy and tasty we are, but we're definitely not high up on the menu, but we are on the menu.
How do we know that?
So typically, lions don't eat humans. They eat lots of what are called ungulates, things like zebras and different bovids, things like wildebeests. And that's what's, you know, fairly common in the ecosystems in which they are present.
And is that just because of the availability of these animals? Or, can we ever possibly know why one animal hunts another?
Sure. So typically we tend to prefer things that are abundant on the landscape that we know will be there, you know, into the future. We tend to diversify the types of prey that we might eat based on availability. At the same time, animals have to be able to effectively hunt them. And so typically things like larger cats tend to be effective hunters at taking down slightly larger prey. And also those prey, if they're larger, have, you know, a benefit in that they're providing more food or meat, right? So large cats may be less effective at taking down small things, right? So whereas a coyote or a cougar can effectively hunt a rabbit, you know, a large cat will be less effective at doing so, will probably have a lower success rate of actually taking down the smaller prey. And so they're typically going to target things that they A, can actually effectively hunt, and B, will have the payoff that they need at the end of it.
Yeah, and I suppose if an animal is hungry enough, I suppose it'll try and eat anything.
Well, I think what's really important to remember is, you know, while we like to think of ourselves on sort of the top of the food chain, are, you know, on the menu for lions. So while it is fairly rare, it's not completely uncommon for man eating to occur. In fact, it's even occurred very recently. So in Tanzania, between January 1990 and September 2004, 563 humans were killed by lions. And then even as recently as 2016, three lions were quote unquote sentenced to captivity after consuming at least three humans.
So it seems obvious that lions would hunt the prey they normally hunt, but if they're not available, they would try other things like human beings because of scarcity of food. But that's not always the case. Can you tell us why, as a paleontologist, you're interested in this subject? And tell us about the story of the Zawa lions.
Sure. So in the case of the Zawa lions, they were two male lions that were shot in 1898 after eating lots of humans. And so Colonel Patterson was sent over to Kenya, the Zawa region, to help oversee the building of the railway. And in the process, these lions were actually actively hunting humans and consuming quite a large number of them. The historical accounts suggest it was somewhere around 135 individuals.
Wow.
Whereas recent studies lower that estimate quite a bit to about 35 individuals. But still, that's a large number of humans that were consumed by these man-eaters.
Yeah. So, what do we know about these lions and their prey at that time?
So we do know that prey was fairly scarce. There was a Rinderpest outbreak that had just recently occurred. We also know that human prey potentially were also increasing in large numbers because of the building of the railway. So you had a decline in ungulate prey, an increase in humans on the landscape. And essentially, the story that was being portrayed is that these animals were sort of desperate and fully consuming carcasses, chomping on bone, and that they were turning to man-eating only in the most desperate of circumstances. I actually have a quote here from Colonel Patterson's book, The Man-Eaters of Zawa and Other East African Adventures. So he says, "I have a very vivid recollection of one particular night when the brute seized a man from the railway station and brought him close to my camp to devour. I could plainly hear them crunching the bones, and the sound of their dreadful purring filled the air and rang in my ears for days afterwards." So that's essentially the story and the picture that was being sort of portrayed. And to be honest, it's a comforting one, right? We like to think that lions are not going to eat us except in the most dire circumstances.
Yeah, and it sounds perfectly reasonable. There wasn't a lot of food around, so these lions turned to humans. End of the story.
Sure. Although now, you know, over 100 years later, since they were shot, we can now apply new tools and techniques to actually study them. And so one of those tools is called dental microwave texture analysis. And essentially what that is we can actually analyze the textures on the teeth themselves, which can give us some indication of what the animal was eating in regards to, was it hard, brittle bones, or was it tough, soft flesh?
And so has that changed the narrative for you with these Zawa lions?
Yes. So we actually expected to see dental microwear, much like a hyena, that showed a very chewed up surface and what we call high complexity in our dental microwear.
This is from chewing on human bones, according to the reports. If these animals ate 35 carcasses of humans, their bones would show the wear and tear of crunching into femurs and so on.
Exactly. Human bones, ungulate bones, bones in general, that they were scavenging. And we actually don't see that at all. What we actually find is that the dental microware of the Tsavo lions and also the Mufui man-eater, which is another man-eating lion that was shot in Zambia in 1991, that all of those lions show greater similarities to captive lions in zoos that are typically provisioned with softer foods, including things like ground meat.
How is that possible?
So a few things. One is that two of the three man-eaters, so one of the Tsavo man-eaters and the Mufui man-eater, had severe injuries to their skulls and their jaws. One had a really large cavity, which abscessed. Another had a severe injury on its lower jaw that looked as if it had sort of a draining fistula. And so as you can imagine, if you have severe injuries to your skull, to your jaw, and that's the main tool at which you use to take down prey and restrain prey, that it's going to be extraordinarily painful to do that. Additionally, you're probably not going to be the most effective hunter if you have that severe severe damage. And so that might have also played a role. But what the results really sort of show is that, you know, they weren't necessarily, you know, so desperate, just consuming carcasses. They basically turned to humans as an alternative prey source, right? They sort of solved their problem. It was likely easier to take down a human, which are abundant and likely exert less, you know, forces and less damage than something like a zebra.
So essentially these lions had toothache. It's sort of like, it sounds like an Aesop's fable, doesn't it? These lions had toothache. And so rather than the strenuous hard work of taking down muscly and hard bony zebras, they sort of like took soup through a straw in the form of a human?
Sort of. So it's one of the things that might have played a role.
I don't understand why these teeth didn't show the same. I mean, if we're eating, humans do have bones. I mean, do we have any sense that they were sort of delicate in how they ate these human beings? Or why did they not have the marks of the human bones on their teeth if they were eating humans?
So things like cheetahs that tend to, you know, eat flesh and concentrate on the flesh and the organs, various things like that, sort of lack these marks that indicate lots of bone consumption, whereas hyenas are actively scavenging. They're getting sort of the end of that carcass. And so, you know, there's much more sort of bone processing. In the case of the man-eating lions, they probably, you know, ate lots of the flesh. In some cases, the humans were actually reclaimed shortly after they were killed. So in the morning, you know, you'd have teams of people go out and try to reclaim the bodies from the lions. And sometimes they were successful in doing that. But even in other things that they were eating, other prey sources, because we do know that they consumed a mix of, you know, humans and non-human prey right before they died, they still weren't scavenging. So this picture of them desperate and scavenging carcasses doesn't really hold up. I think one of the really important things to take away from this study is that while it may be more comforting to think of lions eating us only in the most dire of circumstances, we are essentially on the menu. We've been on the menu for a long time. Anthropological evidence even demonstrates that our early ancestors were consumed by large cats, and we continue to be consumed by large cats, including lions, tigers, and even leopards today. So it's something we really need to think about, especially as we're influencing the decline of prey in many areas and also increasing our own populations where we co-occur with these large cats.
Can I ask you one more quick question? Can you very briefly explain why we care about what lions ate a long time ago? Why spend the resources of paleontology on this?
Sure. There's a few reasons. One is important to sort of understand the ecology of these animals and understand what might influence these lions to switching, you know, prey preferences. And so that's important for us to know in regards to the ecology of these animals. Man-eating is still happening today, so it's important to sort of investigate. In particular, the three lions that were studied, the Tsavo man-eaters from 1898 and also the Mufui man-eater from 1991, those are the few specimens of lions that we actually know were man-eating that are held in museum collections. And so they're some of the few specimens we can actually examine to get some insight onto sort of their motivations.
Larissa DeSantis from Vanderbilt University, thanks very much for coming on.
Thanks so much for having me. Future Proof.
proudly supported by Science Foundation Ireland.
Hashtag believe in science.
Jacques Cousteau loved animals and was very keen to raise awareness around the world about the amazing diversity of marine life. He was a French naval officer. He fell in love with the oceans the first time he wore a diving mask. And over his extraordinary life, he co-invented the regulator, the Aqualung, and various submarines to visit the depths of the waters of this planet to show how beautiful the world is underwater, and was probably one of the most prolific environmentalists. His granddaughter, Alexandra, continues that family legacy, making films for Nat Geo. She is giving a talk tomorrow night to the Bord Gáis Energy Theatre about her work. I'm delighted to say she joins me now. Alexandra, you're very welcome to the programme. How are you?
Good, very good. Nice to be here.
I suppose we can't start this interview without talking about the incredible legacy of your grandfather, and talk about your memories of both your father and your grandfather, because such a prolific family, and also such an interesting way of life it must have been, because you were pretty much born in the sea. You could have been a fish, essentially, Alexandra. Can you talk to us about your early memories of life? Because the Cousteau family were in the sea.
Yeah, I mean, I learned to swim before I could walk, so definitely being
really
groomed and brainwashed appropriately. But and I went on my first expedition when I was 6 months old. So I grew up with this. I didn't really know another way of living. It's just the way it was. And so, you know, I was on my first expedition to Easter Island in Chile when I was 6 months old. And then we were in Uganda. Idi Amin's bodyguards were actually accompanying us to make sure that we could film safely. And there was his chief bodyguard was sort of babysitting me, carrying me around, making sure that we were all safe as we went around. I mean, I know, right? It's kind of crazy to think about. But no, I mean, those were, you know, and my father was ping-ponging between LA and Paris, which is where Cousteau Society had their editing suites and the offices. And, he had his plane, which was a, PBY that could land on water. So we traveled around in that. That was a 10-person crew in the plane. And then there was a Calypso. So there was a lot of moving around.
Yeah.
And that's just kind of how life was for me. My father passed away when I was 4. But I continued to join my grandfather and my grandmother on the Calypso until I was about 14 or 15.
What do these expeditions entail? I mean, when you go out on an expedition with Jacques Cousteau or Philippe Cousteau, what are you, or the expeditions you do now, what are you doing?
Gosh, it's a lot of hard work. You know, you're not cruising on a yacht. Yeah, you're up before dawn. I my mom, you know, would tell me about stories from before I was born, when they would be in certain places doing deep dives 3 times a day. So they'd be up before the sun, having breakfast, getting their equipment ready, going out on the boat, finding the dive site, doing their first dive, decompressing, coming back, having lunch, and then doing the same thing again 2 more times before crashing into bed. Wow. After dinner and being truly exhausted, because scuba diving, you know, is tiring. It's hard work, especially when you're lugging equipment and cameras and lights and doing all of that. So it was really hard work, and they'd be at it for 6 months a year. It was not like it is today, where, you know, budgets are such that you can only go out for maybe a couple weeks unless you have a, you know, a huge budget like BBC had for some of their major series about the environment. I mean, most series you're doing, you know, 13 shows in 4 weeks, maybe.
Yeah.
They would do 1 hour and they'd be in the field for 6 months.
It was an extraordinary time for television, but also it was an extremely popular series, because, you know, your grandfather essentially invented or co-invented the scuba diving and then invented these amazing machines to go to go into the water. And on top of that, he just appeared to be an extremely charismatic, sort of eclectic man. So it just, everything sort of fit to create this. So the expeditions you do now, I mean, is it all about filming and PR, or is awareness, or is there a lot of science done on the expeditions that you do now?
So we're mostly illuminating science and illuminating issues and illuminating people's experiences of changes that are happening. And you know, for us, when in 2010, I did a 5-month expedition traveling around North America from Canada to Mexico, looking at water issues in U.S., Canada, and Mexico. And so we were doing a number of things. We were making short films. It was Nat Geo's first ever interactive expedition. So we were sharing content every day as we went along. And we were stopping in communities and supporting community efforts to restore waterways. And so I was fundraising for those nonprofits because we were fully funded. So I wanted to use the momentum of our expedition to help local NGOs. We did sort of awareness days at local universities. So really, we were storytelling, but we were also advocating for change in the communities and supporting local efforts. And that was part of what made it so meaningful, I think, not just for me, but for our entire crew, was to be able to work so closely with really the people I consider to be heroes in our communities who are working, you know, day after day after day, regardless of who's the president, regardless of what the economy is doing, regardless of what's happening in the world, they're there trying to protect people's resources. And doom and gloom is not going to save the environment. I think what we need to focus on is the stories of hope and change and the people who are finding a way forwards in what is a scary time for all of us, as we try to figure out how we're going to protect the places that we love. And that's what it's all about, is how do we protect what we love? And I think it is under threat, but I think that there are solutions. And the good part is we can all be part of those solutions if we choose to be.
Was there something that you know, particularly struck you going about your work when you went to cover something with National Geographic, and the story that you found was surprising or terrifying or actually not as bad as you thought?
Well, I remember in 2010, we spent a month filming along the Colorado River from source to sea. So we went up into the Rocky Mountains and saw actually where the Colorado begins as a series of small streams and rivulets and wetlands. And then all of that water continues downhill and collects in the Colorado River, which, as most people know, is this huge river that crosses 7 states and provides drinking water and crop irrigation and water for industry to millions and millions of people and communities. Unfortunately, though, we've stuck so many straws in that river that when it hits the Mexican border, rather than continuing on down to the Sea of Cortez, it actually stops. And there's a dam on the border. There is a small amount of water that is released to Mexico because of treaty agreements. And that water is immediately used for local communities and farms. So the wetland that used to exist below that dam was the size of Rhode Island. It was huge, and it supported a whole ecosystem of endangered species. It was a place for migratory birds to stop over and rest and feed. It also supported all of the marine life in the Sea of Cortez, because you know, what many people don't realize is that fresh water from rivers, when it hits the ocean, it creates the brackish conditions necessary for many species of fish and crustaceans to be able to spawn, and for the babies, once they hatch, to live before going out into the open ocean. And so our most productive places are actually where rivers meet the sea. And the Colorado River no longer meets the sea. And so those fisheries have declined, and many of the fishermen no longer are able to make a living fishing, and so they've had to find other work.
Digital marketing, probably.
Yeah.
That's what everybody does actually, when they haven't got a job.
Well, these guys, I don't know if they can do digital marketing, but some of them have tortilla factories and export their tortillas to the U.S. But their true love is fishing. It's what they learned from their fathers and their grandfathers. It was what they wanted to pass on to their sons, which is often how it is with fishing families. And so there's a lot of grief there that not only are they not able to continue doing what they've always done, but that the life in the oceans that they knew growing up is not there anymore. But happily, and this is actually a happy story, there's been a lot of work over the past decade or two between the U.S. And Mexico on the part of politicians and policymakers and scientists and nonprofit groups to be able to allocate more water to the river for environmental purposes. Because, you know, we allocate water to communities, to farms and to industry, but we forget that we also need to allocate it to the environment, because the environment needs it too. All those animals, all those plants, all of those ecosystems need the water just as much as we do, and provide us with important services. And so this effort bore fruit a couple years ago when finally there was an agreement reached between the two countries to release water to the Delta, so that the river could reconnect with the sea. And I was there when it happened, and it was an amazing thing to see. All of the people that had worked on this for so long were there, local communities were there, children who had never seen water in the Delta were there to see water flowing in the riverbed once again. And all along the way, they were documenting as the water flowed through this watershed what would happen. And life started springing back up. Plants that they hadn't seen started coming back, and life that they hadn't seen started coming back. Species that had been gone came back as this water flowed back to the sea.
Wow.
And it's an example for other countries to follow, because rivers are no longer reaching the sea all over the world. You know, we're taking so much out of them that they're just not reaching the sea. And it is an important thing that we need to have happen, for all sorts of different reasons. So it was nice to see that the Colorado, which is such a famous and emblematic river in the world, was an example of how we can come to an agreement to make that happen.
Can I ask you, finally, what can we do? I mean, today is the day where the country and also the world marches for science. And in that, there is an implicit understanding that we need to protect our environment, and we need to look at evidence. What can people do to protect these species that are dwindling away, despite one or two happy stories that you may come across?
Well, I think one of the most important things, and we've seen this with the election of Trump, who denies climate change and is actively working to defund science and defund environmental research and conservation and defund all of the programs that contribute to that. So obviously voting with the environment in mind, really looking at the environmental record of a candidate and deciding whether or not that candidate is doing enough on these issues that are so critical to all of us, is probably one of the most important ways today that we can create change, positive change for climate and for the environment. I think other ways are just looking at the choices that we make. You know, it's important not just to be worried about it and talk about it. That's obviously the first step to change, is being aware of what's going on. But I think, you know, supporting journalism, whether in the United States it's the, you know, National Public Radio. I don't know what the equivalent is for Ireland, but making sure that our journalists are being supported as they try to tell these important stories. And I think looking at what we do at home, one of the biggest ways that we impact our waterways is by what we put down our drain, right? So I heard that in Ireland, not all communities filter their water or treat their water before they release it into a river. We need to be mindful that that has a huge impact on the river. Not just, it's not just human waste. It's also all the chemicals that we put down our drain. It's
antibiotics.
You know, antibiotics, birth control pills, medications, all sorts of things that we really don't want to have in our water is going into our water when we don't treat it before we release it back into the environment. And you know, even communities that treat their water before they release it into the environment haven't addressed sewage overflow. So these are antiquated systems that need to be updated. And so supporting, you know, putting tax dollars to work for those purposes is important.
You know what? Of all the things, I didn't expect to be speaking with you about water charges, which is a subject that is absolutely tearing this country apart in some respects, is not one of them. Look, it's been fascinating speaking with you. Alexandra Cousteau, thank you for your time.
It's been my pleasure.
Future Proof. Proudly supported by Science Foundation Ireland.
Hashtag believe in science.
If you'd like to comment on anything, as always, you can email us science@newstalk.com and we read out emails in length at the podcast, which we can't do on air for many obvious reasons. Last week, we were talking about a bunch of things. We talked about body conscious elephants, elephants that know they're fat. And we spoke of an amazing book by Bo Lotto called Deviate. Someone says, Sean texted in saying, Jonathan, huge build up for Bo on the program, but what a letdown. Now I know how your wife feels most nights. Sean, that is an extraordinarily low blow and I think unwarranted. And I do, you know, to be honest, we did get a few of these texts where people said, look, I didn't quite get that, or I didn't understand it. Someone, Pat, says, whenever I listen to your show, the constant thought that enters my mind is that people have way too much time in their hands. I get that that piece about perception with Bo Lotto wasn't chewing gum for the brain. It wasn't an easy listen. You did have to think about it. You did have to concentrate. And I'm not saying you didn't. Maybe you just didn't like it. But I do think if you didn't get it and you just thought it was rubbish, listen back and really try and follow what Bo was saying, because it literally opened a door into my mind in terms of understanding perception in a completely new way, and how everything around us is just layers of meaning. And that pretty much anything that we can see, touch, smell, taste, it's in our brain, and the rest is just energy and matter. And I even though I knew that, hearing that interview again made me realize it further. We're talking about self-awareness with body conscious elephants. One person says, does an octopus know itself in the mirror? Gotta say, you caught me on the hop with that one. Even though this is a podcast and I could have researched that, I haven't. I don't know. Jerry says, the concepts in this topic, re-elephants and mirrors, are underpinned by those of your previous guest. This is about perception-based. Jerry pointing at the link between the two items, which is sometimes intentional and sometimes just completely random. It's true. The perception of oneself through the mirror, whether you're an elephant or not, is very relatable. Thank you. Amy says, hi, Jonathan. I once had to drive... Oh, this is about you know, how we perceive the world. Amy says, I once had to drive up through Wisconsin in a snowstorm. After a number of hours of perceiving large snowflakes in the foreground and the road stretching into the distance, my depth perception flattened out. It was bizarre and frightening, and as I had to keep driving, definitely relied on experience to judge oncoming traffic as my visual field completely failed me. Which is really fascinating, because that was essentially what you saw was reality, but to your brain it looked like an illusion where you couldn't tell how far things were away because information was coming to you in a way it doesn't normally come to the brain. Brilliant. You know, on this program, so many times I say something and realize I've got that detail wrong and people are going to correct me. And in the interview last week with Bo Lotto, I was talking about the scene of Father Ted where he was saying, no, these cows are near and these cows are far away, because we were talking about perception and stuff. And loads of people have texted in saying it was cows. I can see cows at my window. Father Ted was cows. Was that a Father Ted talk? I think you're thinking of cows. Okay, got it. Okay, I know you love Father Ted, and in my enthusiasm for the thing, it makes it only a greater sin to have gotten it wrong. But there you go. And lots of people texting in about random stuff. Last week was pretty random, it has to be said. But we did get a really nice email from Sean Sean said, thank you for last week's discussion with Bo Lotto. It was indeed mind-altering, as you promised. In your face, Sean. I have also been reading Donald Norman's book, The Design of Everyday Things, and I work in usability testing. While Bo encouraged us to let go of familiar patterns in order that we tap into the creative, Don advises us to utilize the same shared behaviors and patterns when designing, including new technology and computer software, to help users perform the correct actions and experience satisfaction. Can I say even pleasure in their results? You're talking about UX, user experience, the design of what it feels like to interface with a machine. There is a trade-off between the creative and the useful. I began the email with a thank you, a familiar symbol which hopefully elicited feelings of respect and acceptance, and which ended in you reading out my message on the podcast. If I had been more creative with the opening, would it have provoked the same response? Thanks for your great show and stay curious, Sean from Mayo. To be honest, we don't get that many emails, Sean, so I probably would have read it either way. But I also think you're slightly overthinking it. I appreciate the email, though. Thanks very much for that. That is it from us for this week. Do email your thoughts to us, science@newstalk.com. Claire Darmody was producing, Ronan Brannock was researching, on sound was Peter Malloy. We will be back next Saturday with more Future Proof. If you marched for science, or indeed are that matter that you're listening to this program while you march, good on you. We will see you next Saturday for more Future Proof. In the meantime, stay curious.
Future Proof, proudly supported by Science Foundation Ireland.
#BelieveInScience.